You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. And the first thing I want to do is yet again to thank my financial supporters. I just realized I had to pay $800 in back taxes. This, by the way, from someone who's yet to receive either of the stimulus checks. I'm not entirely sure how any of that came about, since, as far as I know, everything is in order. But none of that has materialized. Having to pay that all of a sudden hurt a little bit, but it was extremely helpful to know that my supporters always have my back. For things like this. You guys know that I need very little. It doesn't... I don't require very much to function. I have everything I need. But, as I've said 100 times before, and I'll say it again, my listeners, my supporters, have made it possible for me to be free. That is to say, autonomous. The older conception of freedom prior to the French Revolution, the idea that you don't require, you don't have to satisfy anyone outside of you, an employer or some government official or even a family member. You can think and act according to what you know to be the case rather than what you have to do, and worse, you begin internalizing this coercion as your own point of view, which, by the way, is not too far from what the regime does today. We're living in extremely difficult times. None of this is shocking. None of what we're dealing with right now is a surprise to anybody. And we need to make it very clear that any of our people, at any time, nationalist, paleocon, who advocates violence of any kind, we have to assume that they're working for our enemies. Because the regime wants nothing more than to catch some unstable member of this movement in some kind of a violent act or even a threat. That is absolutely out of the question. We have to remain intelligent, calm, composed, and respectful. And if you can't do that, then maybe this isn't for you. And I think a lot of us have to come to understand this and make this very, very clear, that violence serves only the regime's interest. So, a few years ago when I first had to ask for money, it was very difficult for me. Since for so many years, I gave everything away for free. Unfortunately, those days are long past. The academic world was closed to me permanently. And that meant that I was in some trouble. So again, I want to thank everyone who's assisted me financially in every other way. And it's not just me. There are a few of us full-timers out there that require support. People who have been around a long time, people who put out an interesting and worthwhile product, someone who's original. Yes, there are not that many of them, but these are some of the criteria you look for in someone to support, someone who's proven themselves over the years, someone who's not a fly-by-night institution or personality. As it stands right now, we are much less a movement and much more a collection of idiosyncratic personalities. We are struggling, we are suffering, and the last thing we should do is to turn on each other. Now, in that vein, I want to discuss a few things. Some time ago, I both wrote and spoke on Metropolitan Ivan Snitchev of St. Petersburg, who died in 1995. I've done at least one broadcast many years ago on him, and he's someone I go back to over and over again. I don't know how much of his material is in English, but what makes him an eccentric character is that he was under the Moscow Patriarchate. Because he was under that institution much later in the life of the Soviet Union, it's not a huge surprise that he continued to function. He was a firm Russian patriot, a nationalist, a monarchist, but he never left the Patriarchate itself. And he understood the true Orthodox Church and its mission, he never joined it or supported it. And we could leave that alone. That's not something we can make a big deal about, especially under the circumstances. None of us were in the Soviet Union in the 60s and 70s. And to know what pressures were on you. We're going to be experiencing that soon. Many of us have lived like that for some time. Metropolitan John died in 1995. He viewed himself as continuing the work of the great Konstantin Pobedonostsev. Again, I've written and dealt with him over and over again. His work is in English. He's someone who is ritually condemned in every textbook in Russian history, so you know he must be saying something right. But Snitchev is, it's an odd, S-N-Y-C-H-E-V in Latin letters, clearly of German background, and it's been, you know, Russianized in one form or another. But his work brought the nationalist message right to the Communist Party itself. And he became active precisely at the time when the USSR began to disintegrate. So from the mid-80s. And one of his central targets was the concept of democracy. And he makes it very clear in work after work after work that the democratic ethos has nothing to do with the rule of the people. It has nothing to do with the fact that the people, in quotes, doesn't refer to anything. There is no such entity. Democracy is inherently nominalist, so there is no such... So the very, very reference to the people is already a lie, since they can't make a reference to something universal, but they do it all the time. Even the Russian translation, if you don't use the Russianized version of the English word with the Greek root, it does have the word people or narod, but narod in Russian means more than just an abstract people. It does refer to a functional nation. Now, it's very common for our opponents to use sleight of hand and dishonesty in any discussion or debate we have with them. That's pretty much all they know. It's extremely rare to find someone who, especially today, who's willing to have a principled discussion with you. There are a few, and they should be taken very seriously. But often what our opponents will do is they'll take a point of view that they dislike, politically speaking. So they'll talk about, you know, nationalism, they'll talk about royalism, they'll talk about some kind of authoritarian government. They'll then contrast that to an ideal of either socialism or democracy. The dishonesty, of course, that they'll take a functioning, living idea, so an actual government, let's say, you know, Royal Russia, but they won't put it up against a living, breathing democratic system. They'll put it up against the ideal of democracy or socialism. So they'll say something stupid, like, Tsar Nicholas II was a tyrant. Look at all these terrible things he did. But the truth is that government should respond to the will of the people and the rights of man. Now, usually that will get you applause at a university, but understand the blatant dishonesty there. He made reference to an actual person, a mythic idea of what sort of a person that was, claimed that that was actually how that government functioned, but then contrast that to a purely ideal conception of will of the people or rights of man. It's an extremely common form of dishonesty, and be careful when you come across it. But that democracy is based on untruth is one of Metropolitan John Sneetch's essential points. And he makes this point that in none of the countries that are considered democratic, in none of these do the people, this abstraction, actually govern, or even the majority, or even a large proportion. All the anti-democratic thinking, whether it be Popedonistiev, Leontiev, you know, by the truckload, all make the same claim, and it's impossible to deny, that when you take actual functioning democratic systems, you have only the rule of politicians, big money, and today, media. It has absolutely nothing to do with people, you know, in this mythic Rousseauian idea of people gathering under a tree and working out their problems through rational discussion. Now, that may fit an ideal conception of aristocracy, but never, except in the imagination of some of these people. And by the way, that was not Rousseau's view, but he's often, you know, mythically tied to that. That might be a conception of aristocracy, but that's simply not how people function. And democracy is mass democracy. Political science is a technical field, which is very difficult, no different than any other field. When you reduce everything to media or entertainment level sound bites, and that's how, you know, so-called debate goes on, then there is no connection between voting and policy. If you're going to vote in an election, and I've spoken about this, I have papers on this, there's a lot of assumptions you have to make, and one of the more ridiculous is that there's a direct connection between the people I vote for and them taking office, than the policy that either I want or that they promise coming to fruition. It simply doesn't happen, especially in a system like the American, where the machinery, being, you know, Republican in a very vague sense, is designed so that laws cannot be passed because you vote a group of people in. That is simply not how it's done. Over the last year, the regime has condition the typical American to accept rule by decree, rule by executive order, rule by a claimed emergency situation. I said when this when the lockdown first hit back in March and April, I read in great detail the federal disaster and emergency legislation, and there's quite a bit of it. And none of it, whether at the state or the federal level, ever gave government the right to shut down businesses or to tell people where to go. Emergency legislation is mostly concerned with the direct control over resources, direct control over, you know, military forces, the National Guard, health department, hospitals, that kind of thing. It changes how, you know, the budget is distributed, you know, just for the length of the emergency. It has nothing to do with how citizens behave. So Snitchev makes it very clear that this is often how democratic systems run. I did my dissertation on Professor Michael Oakeshott, the British idealist or British Hegelian who died in the early 90s. And he mocks the idea of a so-called democratic government. There is no such thing because governments have to function through bureaucracies of all various types. Bureaucracies are organized the exact same way, regardless of how politicians come into office. Politicians coming into office face the same problems, the same pressures, the same elites, regardless whether they're elected or appointed or take over in a coup. Generally speaking, bureaucracy functions the same. Therefore, the concept of a democracy simply refers to the periodic voting for a slate of candidates that take office and then allegedly put the policies that they've been promising into action. Not only does that never happen, but that's not how the U.S. government is designed. Beside the fact that the candidates that people vote for are chosen usually by major media. Almost always by major media at the state and federal level. If you don't get media attention, you simply don't exist. Money follows the candidate that gets the most media attention. And there really is no other functioning criterion today. So Shnitsev says that in Russian, he says the final fruit of state power, the final result of power, is always rests in the hands of a narrow layer, a closed corporation of people whose mission is politics. A politician functions in a cruel and ruthless struggle for power. It simply doesn't matter how they justify their power, whether they've been elected or whether they've been appointed. Most of the people who make policy in the United States are bureaucrats or judges. And certainly far more powerful and far closer to the average voter is corporations. There is no connection between a democratically elected politician, which means, you know, usually a very small portion of the electorate vote for this person, because most people don't vote, especially congressional elections, off year, that has an immediate connection with policy. There is simply no connection. A freshman congressman is pretty worthless when he goes to Capitol Hill for the first time. But the state, and he's of course referring to the Russian monarchy, that governments are carefully crafted from generation to generation, designed to be a reliable support, the basic minimum of public order, rather than an arena where the passions of politicians can be worked out. And he says that the royalist system skillfully guarded itself from the temptations of a democratic contagion. A democracy, and what he means by that is that democracy shows the power of quality over quantity. The democratic mentality doesn't understand variations in quality. It knows numbers, it knows money, it knows votes, it knows opinion polls. And almost all of these are manipulated at all levels. None of it is actually real. He quotes Lev Tikhomirov, who I've quoted on here many times. The realization of the democratic idea means the power of quantity over quality, the power of the ignorant. Behind the scenes, those who control the mob skillfully. All of this causes meaninglessness. The notions of truth and justice, good and evil, are tried and are determined mechanistically by a majority vote. Now, even if that were an accurate depiction, there is no majority vote. Most people, when they vote, aren't even aware of truth, justice, or good or evil. They vote because they think they have to. They vote based on party affiliation, name recognition, anything but abstractions like truth and justice. They're simply unaware. Most people vote because they think that they're supposed to. So this is even one more step removed from reality. But Sinichev says that the concept of general and direct suffrage is immoral because it institutionalizes cynicism and it brings it to a very high level. People begin to realize very quickly that they are the subject of dishonorable manipulators. And he makes it clear. Now, this is written probably in the early 90s. I'm actually citing a few essays here. Most of them are from the early 90s. He says, with the development of modern media, these politicians are gaining a scope of power that no other power-hungry person could ever have hoped for before. And he makes the claim. He says, why doesn't anyone think of choosing a surgeon or an investigating judge or a driver or an aviator with the help of universal suffrage? It's harder to manage a scalpel, a bus, or a plane than to manage a huge country. Or is it harder, he's asking. And of course, the answer is simply no. One is a technical skill. Another combines skill and art. Every field of society is brought to bear on matters of state. Now, he also said that that doesn't mean that electability isn't an issue, or that they should be completely excluded. And says it's irreplaceable in certain places as a way to establish a parliamentary unity, he says, of people and state. But the area of that application has to be clearly and precisely defined. And he says something, of course, you know, people like me have been saying for many decades. Exclude the democratic vote. Where such a position or job or duty requires a high professional quality that the average mass man simply is not aware of. And then any kind of voting scheme has to have authoritative representatives of all social classes, professional, ethnic groups, whatever. And then they're represented proportionally. Just adding votes doesn't mean anything. It doesn't tell you anything. No one has a mandate here. As it stands right now, of course, someone like Joe Biden, to the extent he even knows where he is most of the time, has no mandate to anything. The man wasn't legitimately elected. But I'm telling you that no one is legitimately elected. And even if they were, the policies that they have something to do with putting into place are not of their own making. Sinichev is extremely important. The old French revolutionary doctrines, this bizarre triumvirate, the anti-trinity of the rights of man, you know, freedom, brotherhood, liberty, egalitarianism, the entire movement. We all know what this is. There is no equality in nature. Liberty, equality, fraternity. There, I thought of it. It's a strange thing for me to forget, but It's okay. But these things, at least in their initial French, not only are contradictory, not only are they fighting one another, but they're abstractions. They don't actually refer to anything. You know, and liberty and freedom are not the same thing. Fraternity has absolutely no meaning. They're not referring to the community of the nation. If they refer to a nation, they're not referring to an ethnic group. Now, that could be the basis of legitimate fraternity. But that does not imply either freedom or equality, especially since freedom and equality are often at war. The natural order, Snitchev says, is not only infinitely diverse, but strictly hierarchical. Nowhere in the natural order, including in the rational one, is there anything approaching absolute liberty. You see almost an unlimited interdependence. You see a lawful order of phenomena. And in a democratic system deriving from the French Revolution, how can there possibly be any fraternity? Since that implies a strict limitation on the choice of man, and in fact has a very powerful moral foundation in and of itself. The left is always talking about community. They never define it. But what Onestiev said under Tsar Alexander III, he said, when the Democrats wanted to turn this form into an obligatory law of social existence, when they wanted to make this into a formal law to people connect from within and connect with the government externally, it proved to be a fatal lie. An ideal love of law, peace, and patience, which is reduced to a mechanistic external decree, making it become a law of violence, discord, and fanaticism. Liberty, you know, equality, fraternity. These things are abstractions. They're meaningless statements. They're words without context, which means that the ruling regime can fill them with whatever content they want. They can use them to justify completely contradictory points of view. And I'll say this a million more times, but when the regime makes reference to democracy, they're simply talking about left liberalism. They're talking about a modernized version of the French Revolutionary guillotine. But what Onestiev is saying here, and what Snitchev is citing, is that you can't take an ideal, whether we accept it or not, the trinity of the French Revolution, you can't take those vague ideas and make them laws. In order to take it from this ideal state and turn it into a law that's written down in books and interpreted by judges, that dissent destroys it. How can you legislate something like liberty? The minute you refer to the law, the minute you make these parameters and use language, because you're not referring to any actual people, you're referring to ideal people, or maybe not people at all. These are abstractions divorced from any being that might carry them out. You make them something very different from the vague, misty ideas we have of them when we utter the words. That's why it becomes violent. That's why it becomes fanatical. My dissertation on Michael Oakeshott came down to the fact that the use of revolutionary language, whether it be Marxist or liberal, exists only in the linguistic realm. It exists nowhere else but in language. To take that from its ideal state to something that you can function in every day as a law, as a decree, as a bureaucratic protocol, it's no longer an ideal. It then becomes muddied with the day-to-day of political ugliness and power and ego. To connect an ideal with law requires often extreme forms of violence. And this Michael Oakeshott refers to as revolutionary ideology. This is why revolutions are violent. That's not his phrase, that's the phrase that I used. But the revolutionary ideology is violent by definition. There's no way to connect an ideal with an actual functioning people or a law code except through violence. You're forcing people into a cookie cutter. And a cookie cutter is just that. It's a cutter. It slices everything off. Now, when he's referring to monarchy, of course, you have, you know, the freshman in college mentality that believe that it's the same thing as arbitrariness, dictatorship, unlimited, uncontrolled power, because someone used the word absolute once. Monarchy, in fact, there is no such thing as an absolute state. It simply can't exist. No government has the infinite resources you would need to control every breath, every movement, to regulate every syllable of your day-to-day life and speech. No system can do that. When royalists use the word absolute, and that's more of a modern term, they're referring to absolute responsibility. They're referring to a law that's absolute in the sense that it's connected with natural law, not the creation of deeply flawed human beings. I have a book coming out very soon on medieval political thinking. The difference between medieval and modern, to be very general about it, is that the medieval idea seeks to discover law, to find its natural foundation, and conform ourselves to it. The modern wants to legislate it, to write it, to invent it. Because a modern idea, if it's anything, is a rejection of the idea that there is any such thing as natural law when it comes to morals or politics. There's natural law on everything else, which is what science is supposed to understand. The only time it doesn't matter is when you're talking about human behavior. It's always been the strangest weakness, this bizarre black spot in Enlightenment thinking. They can create a scientific establishment that can create tremendous tools and weapons, but can't in no way tell you how they should be used. Everything is very rigorous and quantitative and scientific in the best sense of the term, except how you're to behave, how to use that power. Ridiculous social sciences like sociology. I say they're ridiculous because they're one and two syllable versions of political philosophy and economics and history. They actually attempt to try to operationalize, to quantify every aspect of social life. Their very structure is incorrect. So Nietzsche is talking about the royal state, and he makes it clear it's the perfect form of the rule of law in the sense that it requires nothing else. Natural law is all there is. It binds the responsibility of those in power and those who obey to the highest source of the legal idea, which of course is divine law. There's no such thing as natural law without God. You can't have an immutable law of nature without the God that creates it, because immutability itself has to have a cause. He defines the Orthodox monarch as a conscientiousness, a Christian patriotism, based on canons and commandments, not just on paper, but also connected with the development of a society. It is a protection against the unlimited ambitions of what he calls a moderate and power-loving politicians. They will divide and destroy the economy based on whatever ambition they happen to have and whoever's paying the bills. Royalism, no matter where it's found, accepts God and the natural law that he creates as the only source of power. The people, that vague, meaningless collection is not a source of power, since there is no such thing as the people. It doesn't matter how much they agree, it doesn't matter how many there are. From a Christian point of view, the people's government is utter nonsense. The people can be debased just like anybody else, just like the state can. People can't delegate their power to make laws to anybody because they don't have that power in the first place. The legal basis, legal fundamental mentality of democracy, the existence of these innate human rights, which are supposed to be taken from their ideal state and made into the mechanistic form of legislation, are supposed to be the root of how the state functions. It's as false and as artificial as all ideological conceptions are. The ancient medieval world knew nothing of the individual as an isolated monad, as an entity outside of context, which individualism has to accept, which, by the way, is a universal. But the Enlightenment Western European mentality is completely foreign to its own tradition, and certainly to the mentality of the East. But then he gets to the root of the problem. Liberal democracy is based on financial speculative capital. With the creation of a very weak state, bound by laws that the powerful create for it, that capital itself doesn't have to follow. The criminal on the street always has an advantage over the policeman, because generally speaking, the policeman has to follow the law. The criminal does not. And the criminal, if he has a good lawyer, is able to exploit all the niceties of the law to stymie the action of the state, especially if that state really doesn't want to win the war in the first place. But financial capital constructed this mechanism, what he calls a spiritless technological civilization. This mentality has no room for a conscience. Can't be the conscience is not quantitative. If morals can be voted on, then so can mental health. It turns men, as he would say, into a half animal, half machine, an impersonal screw in a giant machine whose only all-consuming goal is money. This has nothing to do with satisfying actual natural needs. The democratic civilization is really an anti-civilization. It establishes a cult of violence, debauchery, the tolerance of evil, or the non-existence of evil. And every perversion of human nature can become law. The natural law, logos, is overthrown. Then a man can call himself a woman, and you have to go along with it, because there is no natural fundament. So the sins and the passions of fallen man swell to enormous proportions. They're constantly encouraged, and they become a source of unscrupulous and dishonorable living, he says. The whole idea of everything being for sale, self-interest, that you only live once, which he quotes here, actually that slogan, that they erode morality and they disintegrate not only personal moral code, but national self-consciousness. The state itself becomes criminalized. And remember, he's writing this in the early 90s in Russia, where even the basics of law and order had broken down, and criminal bosses, with American support, took over the country, the so-called oligarchs as we understand them. Now, Snitsov makes it clear, and this is one of the things that the Democrats in Russia at the time really lost it with, his understanding of the fatherland, of nationalism. He says that, of course, there is one world under the rule of one king of heaven. that has absolutely nothing to do with how we relate to our neighbor. What he calls a special love for the fatherland is extremely important morally. And he says it's precisely because he did not choose his fatherland. It was appointed to him at birth. Our compatriots are connected in a healthy society by one religion, common origin, language, law, memories of the people, the troubles of ancestors, military leaders, emperors, and everything else. That's what binds people together. That's a specific manifestation of natural law. That's how human beings function. That's what a community is. The fatherland, he says, is something that's sanctified by the good deeds of previous generations, but also what God has blessed the territory with. All the good deeds that have occurred, of God's blessings on the people, the martyrs, those who shed blood for it. This sanctifies the land and the population that derives from it. So he makes it clear that refusing to be a nationalist, refusing to love the fatherland and its people, is identical with hating and being ungrateful to your own parents. Any kind of devotion for those who did not give birth to us, who did not raise us, is no different than dishonoring your father and mother. And this gets worse. Remember, he's writing this in the 90s, where you have foreigners coming in with an imperial liberal ideology who didn't care at all for the average Russian person. All they saw is a new arena for products to be sold, a new market to open up and to manipulate. All the labor of previous Russian generations would be completely disintegrated, and the Americans and the Europeans would go in and set up shop. And thank God this didn't happen, to at least to the extent that it happened elsewhere. Now, he also says, and this is not something that's a huge problem anymore, but any kind of blind attachment, any kind of unworthy attachment. He says when a Russian brags that he's proud to be a Russian, and then somehow unreasonably hates everybody else, that is equally irrational, although I've never met anyone like that before. That's mostly an invention of the liberal imagination. Kuznetsov, like many Russians, talks about the Masonic cults. And this is very easy to misunderstand, since most people don't know the first thing about Gnosticism, the Kabbalah, and then they really can't be expected to. The mass mind doesn't understand what the Masonic cult is. But to put it in the most simple way you can possibly think of, it is a secret society that has the money and the resources to rule over society without revealing what the final agenda is. Now, this at this point is impossible to deny that there is a tiny group of people who control capital, who do know each other, who do work together, and have an agenda for us that they're not telling us about. To reject that is simply to be ignorant. That's very easy to demonstrate, and frankly, they're not really interested in hiding that much anymore. So that's the minimal idea of this kind of Masonic secret society. And there's a deeper theological meaning behind it, which we're not going to get into here. I've gotten into that elsewhere. But whether it be Bolsheviks or the French Revolutionary Masons or anything else, it is a secret cult of very powerful men who want to have absolutely no limitations on their power, which is why the church and monarchy are always their enemy. And again, he's writing this at a time where the Russian economy simply no longer existed. So the Bolsheviks couldn't destroy the church. Now in the 90s, liberalism will erode it from within. So they'll bring in the Protestants and the Mormons. They'll bring in all forms of liberal ecumenism of every possible way, feminism, anything you could think of. So they attempted to destroy the church by sending it to the gulag. That failed. And so the next stage is to attempt to subvert it internally. And usually with foreign, in the Russian case, foreign ideologies. And the humiliation of the Russian tradition, which frankly, not a whole lot of Russians today understand. Americans are completely ignorant of their own people. And this is, you know, unfortunately the case in many places. Sinichev mentions, he talks about the Gospel of Matthew. And I'm quoting here directly from the Russian. It says, "Take heed, ye not be afraid, for all these things must be done. Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom." From Matthew 24. He said that this is not a prophecy of world wars. Some of the worst, really Protestant-inspired kind of biblical interpretation comes from the assumptions that what we believe these terms mean in a modern context is what they meant 2,500 years ago or more. It's not true. No, what he's referring to, the most brutal battle, are the Orthodox people against the lawless, against false teachers, the godfighters, as they'll say, the forerunners of the Antichrist, the zealots. This lawlessness, or of course, in which their spirit belongs to the kingdom of darkness and Satan, the ruler of that kingdom, and then shall many be offended and betray one another and shall hate one another, as the scripture says. This is the final battle, and it's not merely a physical one, it's also a psychological one. We have to fight this within ourselves as well as in the political realm. Now, as far as what we do, Sinichev has three elements. And this is something that I'm going to be talking about in the future. The psychological fallout from having to live under this regime. None of our people are dealing with this problem right now. How do we function as human beings under this pressure? Well, Sinichev, of course, you know, being raised in the Soviet system, does have some insight into this, and he has three elements. The first is based on understanding. Salvation is our personal resistance to evil. This is how we go from the vanity and lies of the world to the joys of the divine. We are meant to virtuously build this inner temple, as he calls it. If we build this, the Lord will sit in it. His throne of power and glory, which is within us. This is an internal struggle, which is connected to, but not identical with, the political one. And its foundation is our personal resistance to evil, to separate ourselves from it. The second thing, as he says, is to bring everyday life into harmony with the truth of the faith. The notion of brotherhood and humility. Personal gain can't really be the issue. The good deeds and the humility that we need has to do with the revival of parishes, of communities and families. And usually there isn't an immediate financial or physical gain that comes from these things. To live as, you know, with one mouth and one heart, as is said, is not something that comes easy. Not for people who are raised in an individualistic mentality. This is not something that, it doesn't require superhuman effort, but humility. And humility is putting a brake on our ego. We don't seek personal glory, but salvation, which drives from humility. The third, he says, to consolidate all areas of life, social, state, personal, family, consolidated into one single integral whole. He says this isn't really a matter of external action. It's not necessarily something that can be brought about by decrees or orders or congresses or conferences. It starts at the individual level. All of these three things are based on personal resistance. As time goes on, I'm going to be dealing with these issues in a bit more detail. But it all comes down to, and he writes in a journal called Soviet Russia, it's March 22nd, 1994. He says, the life of any people, of any human community, is based on the unity of the worldview which determines moral, ethical, and religious norms of behavior. Personal, family life, social, and state life, or public life, equally depend on what is recognized by all of us as acceptable and what is not acceptable, what's revered as good and what is reviled as evil, the meaning of human existence, and what is its highest, eternal, and enduring goal. Without those things, you simply don't have a community. Without those, and those are just basic fundamental things. Without them, you can't have a rational economy. You can't have rational discussion. Without agreement on fundamentals, you can't have any debate, because we don't even define words in the same way. And he says, throughout the history of mankind, it was religion that was the organizing ethical principle. He calls it a fastener. It unites people around ideals, gave strength to national states, and uniformity to national character. The differences in everyday life, in psychology, in family, the historical fate of peoples, are rooted primarily in the religious realm. Now, those two quotations encapsulates everything that he's trying to say. You can't have a single society where you have this collision of contradictory and even mutually exclusive beliefs. You're talking about religion. You're talking about that which, at its most fundamental, people live for. What is important and what isn't? You just take a random person off the street and ask him those questions. What do you think you're going to get? Generally speaking, you're going to get someone who has never even thought about these things. They don't even know where to go for information or even understand the question, let alone can provide you with an answer. Now, in the healthiest of societies, it's not a world of philosophers. You wonder why, you know, the immigrant Orthodox parishes are such wonderful, for me anyway, wonderful experiences. It's because it's not based on articulated principles. It's simply based on how they've always done things, how they've survived in the past. That simplicity, which I've experienced myself, contains far more value than the words that we use in describing these things. It's not a matter of having to explain this in great philosophical depth. But how do they live? To take an American who doesn't even understand a question like that, well, it's not as if you can follow them around and see their lives and see, well, these principles are manifest in behavior. They're not. Therefore, community, given that, is absolutely impossible. That means community has to be something that now is created deliberately. Communities aren't created deliberately. They're created over a long period of time. However, they can be built due to suffering and struggle, which is where we are right now. Successful nation building is based on unity of religion, which is the same thing as unity of fundamental moral understanding. Whether articulated or not is not important. And it's that foundation that Schnitzov begins to say that this is why the so-called Judeo-Christian idea is absurd. The two opposite forces in European life for two millennia has been the tikkun olam of the Jewish mentality, the Kabbalah, the post-logos idea and Christian natural law. Sinitsev says that the spiritual principles of these two sides are opposite and they're irreconcilable. Sinitsev says that modern Judaism doesn't have, in any normal sense, any positive religious content. And as Sinitsev and so many others, E. Michael Jones and great writers have said, the minute Christ was executed, they have rejected the notion of logos. Their world became anti-Christianity, anti-logos, anti-natural law. This is why Russia, in his mind, and certainly mine, has been target number one. Because of its size, because of its success, especially in the 19th century, its exploding population, its natural resources, the potential, the fact that it could very easily be an autarkic state, it became the primary threat. But he does say that this is a matter not so much of inter-ethnic relations, although it certainly has that manifestation. It is a matter of spiritual life. Ethnicity is no different than families. The church, however, is based on the idea of law. And I don't mean, you know, positivist law on paper, but on God's creation. And this is something fully understood in pre-revolutionary Russia. And what lies at the basis here, the irreconcilable contradiction of these two worldviews, is that only one can win at any given moment. Both Russians and the Talmudists have this sense of messianic fervor and chosenness, at least at one point, that this is why Russia was the threat. Christ testified he walked his own the way which ended up in the cross, the way of the cross. The sacrifice and selflessness become the fundamental commandments of morality. But only, of course, to those in the brotherhood who can be benefited by the brotherhood. Now, of course, the Jewish idea of chosenness is very different, he says. The concept always has been that as man in the world stands above animals, so Jews stand high above all the nations of the world, which is straight out of the Talmud. The concept of chosenness has to do with global rule, tikkun olam, fixing the errors that the goyim live within. And from that, the Jew in the Talmudic sense has no moral obligation to the Gentile. So justice and mercy, honesty, gratitude from this point of view are not applicable to anyone but those who support the Talmudic mentality. So the Christian idea is one of service and brotherhood, subordinates, conciliarity. The Talmudic idea is one of utter dominion and control. But either way, this impacts the idea of community and brotherhood that the nation takes for granted. The division of a once single humanity into different races and tribes took place at the direct command of God in Genesis 11. The Orthodox Church has always taught that every nation, as what he calls a conciliar person, has its own special guardian angel. And the mystery of nationality, as he says, is rooted in the mystic depths of a people's life, being one of the most important, most fundamental principles of human existence, a guarantee of that spiritual unity, without which the very existence of a people, society, and state is inconceivable. And to conclude, Sinitsev says something that I hadn't thought of until I read this. But because of that fact, because of the notion of this being the fundamental spiritual organizing principle, there is no single acceptable materialistic definition of a nation. The secular definitions, whether it be Marxist or fascist or liberal, are not only theoretically flawed, but completely untenable, even at the practical level. A national policy has to be based on the spiritual life. The idea of a nation derives from natural law. But nationality is, as he says, the mystic depths of a people's life. And that means it is a fundamental principle, it's an axiomatic principle of human existence. It's even more fundamental than cognition itself. It's a spiritual unity that often can't necessarily be placed into words or laws. It's that which laws and words come from. It's hard to prove something that's necessary for any proof to exist at all. We say this about God, especially in the logical sense. There is no rational definition of a nation that's purely materialistic and naturalistic. That's because it's far deeper than that. So which definition, which conception of our community are we going to listen to? And that's what he, that was his mission, and that should be ours as well. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.